3:07. We're going to go ahead and gavel. Let me get started here today. With us is February 11th or February 14th. Happy Valentine's Day. See all the red out there. I should remember that. Representative Herron is here. Representative Miller. Representative Seaton. And I would assume there'd be more coming here shortly. We have two bills in front of us today. HB 209 and HB 310. HB 209 is on tobacco cessation, and HB 310 is the immunization program. I don't intend to move either bill. We're in learning mode. We can be collegiate here and slow and deliberative, and that's what the intent is. So we'll get back to them at a later date as we go. So why don't we go ahead and get started? The sponsor of HB 209 and 310 is Representative Herron, and he's on the committee, and he's just going to stay up here and testify on the bill, and then we have testifiers online or in the room. We'll go there. So, Representative Herron, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, come on. Oh, okay, fine. Yeah, okay, great. Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 209, insurance coverage for tobacco cessation. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your willingness to hold this hearing. As you know, dependence on tobacco is chronic. It affects negatively the health, productivity, and well-being of all Alaskans that choose to indulge in tobacco. Now, tobacco, as you know, Mr. Chairman, is the leading cause of death, killing more Alaskans than suicide, motor vehicle crashes, liver disease, etc., combined. So, in addition to these detrimental health effects, negative economic impacts are huge. Tobacco use costs Alaskans well over $300 million in direct medical expenditures and an additional $177 million in lost productivity. As you know, I never picked up the habit, but my sons chew tobacco. My wife used to smoke, and it's a hard habit to kick. So this legislation, as proposed, does not force anyone to give up their habits, but offers Alaskans who choose to want the resources and support they need to successfully end their tobacco addiction. Now, Mr. Chairman, as you know, the bill that we introduced, I've asked you to offer to the committee an amendment on this part, is that it would have health care insurers offer cessation treatments each year, including medication. Consumers, will not be required to use these sessions, but it gives us some flexibility in choosing to quit. Now, Mr. Chairman, you share the concerns of many people that this mandate aspect of this bill. And so during this hearing and the future hearings that you will schedule, hopefully, is that we'll listen to testimony on both sides of the issues. So, Mr. Chairman, Liz Clement, is here for technical assistance to us, but I look forward to the testimony and our deliberation after today on potentially moving this from committee. Thank you.
You made reference, Representative Herron, to my concerns with a mandate, and just very briefly on that, as I understand this, the bill does put down a requirement for just the private sector insurance, and that's a small percentage of your welfare programs and the options out there to cover people. So, yes, I do share that concern. Yeah, did I understand that you were saying that the amendment you would like to make is to mandate that this is a policy that would be available as an option for people to buy as opposed to mandate coverage. Is that the idea?
Yes, sir. Delete the word provide and insert the word offer in a couple places. in having conversations with many people is maybe this is something that the testimony and the subsequent dialogue can flesh out, see if it's practical in doing that. So I look forward to our dialogue, and especially to the testimony, both that like this approach and those that would care to tell us how it can be a better product.
Do you know, Representative Herron, if we do that for other coverage mandate A policy be available as opposed to, I mean, what else have we told the insurance company they have to have a policy there for sale without mandating the coverage, you know?
I guess I'll defer to that question because I want to give a better informed answer, so I'll
that's what I'd like to know.
I'll brief up on that.
I understand there are a couple, and because I have looked into it in a little bit, not much, but I would also like to know how that's worked out, you know, from the insurance companies, you know, how many people take it and if it's worked out in the past. Any other questions? Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering, I was looking on page 2 under the coverage, and on line 2 it says that the treatment may not, and then on number 3 down there on line 7, require an individual to participate in a counseling session in order to receive coverage for medication. And but on page 1, line 11, the coverage is for not less than 4 tobacco cessation counseling sessions. I'm just cursory reading. Can you explain the difference in those counseling sessions, or is that a requirement the same?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, is so I would ask the chairman if we bring Liz up that can, you know, maybe provide some clarification there.
I'm sorry, I just assumed you had come up. You're so much part of the team here, Liz. If you would, before you say anything, just make sure you identify yourself for the record. And go ahead, sure.
Certainly, thank you so much, Chair Keller. For the record, my name is Liz Clement. I am proud staff to Representative Bob Herron. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I believe the way I read this is that the insurers would be required to cover at least 4 counseling sessions per course of treatment. However, individual consumers choosing to use this coverage would not be forced to do any counseling sessions as a condition of taking advantage of the treatment coverage overall. The reason behind that being experience has shown that people who are trying to quit tend to have far greater success rates when they have some say in how they choose to quit. For some, counseling will be a big part of that. For others, it's somewhat of a deterrent, actually.
Follow up?
Thank you. And, yeah, it's just a little confusing on those. So the structure of this bill is then on page 2, where the coverage for tobacco cessation treatment may not require a person to get pre-authorization, or referral from a healthcare provider, or participate in a counseling session. So this is a individual is covered under the insurance to, on their own, without any healthcare consultation, to purchase or to buy attend 4 counseling sessions or over-the-counter medication or prescribed medication approved by the Food and Drug Administration, so they can get, does the bill require them to get, be able to get prescriptions without a prescription, because they can't be, there's not a referral from a medical, and yet as I read it, there's 2 things. One is that they are without contact to the insurer or any healthcare provider, they can go get counseling. I don't quite know how the billing works there, but and because I don't see either an and or an or on two, and so I'm trying to figure out whether the coverage on B that's starting on line 9, page 1, that what it covers. So is the intent here that it would cover either this or that or both, or is it a requirement that someone does both?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
Thoughts, please.
Mr. Chairman, can I read? I know I was confusing when I said that.
Let's start over with Representative Seaton's question.
Thank you.
And then we can help him out. We can add.
On page 1, section B, starting on line 9, it says what the coverage is. And there's two things. Under subsection 1, there's a not less than 4 tobacco counseling sessions provided by a qualified counselor. So I don't know if there's any limitations. I mean, can it be 10 as well? But that's one thing. That's the counseling sessions. And then there's a semicolon. And then there's over-the-counter or prescription medication, which is a separate item, but I'm not sure whether there's to be an or between those or an and, or whether it's interpreted as and or.
Thank you.
You don't have to answer now. We could, because we are coming back to this, but if you'd like to, go ahead. I mean, we're not trying to trap you here. So.
Certainly, and that is very much appreciated, Chair Keller. If I may, just to clarify for present purposes, I would say that, yes, Representative Seaton, you are correct on the number of counseling sessions. The insurer would be required to cover at least 4. They could choose to cover more, but that just sets the minimum number that they would have to cover. I believe the intent of the bill, and I would defer to Representative Heron on this, but as it's written, I believe there should be an and, page 1, line 13, to provide both the counseling sessions and the over-the-counter or prescribed medications.
Just to follow up and to add to that, when you're clarifying that later, you might want to look at subsection C and same question and or, you know, where they fit there in the 1, 2, 3, 4.
And thank you. And that may be a question for Ledge Legal to ask, you know, on the on the drafting and what that drafting means. I'm just not familiar, not having an and or having an or, how the drafting interpretation is. So I'm just trying to understand the bill.
We're going to go to the sponsor, Representative Heron, and then what I'd like to do is we'll stop the questioning for a moment and take some testimony from Boston because it's a different time zone and we don't want to lose them and whatever. So Representative Heron.
Yeah, I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the question is that, you know, we're not interested in legislating over-the-counter medication, but we have to be careful with the prescribed part of this legislation. That's my only comment. But I look forward to the testimony that can maybe straighten us all out here.
Okay. Well, what I'm going to do is open public testimony. Liz, feel free to stay there. And in a few minutes, I'm going to close it again, and we'll finish the questions and the presentation. So we're in public testimony now. For the purposes of taking testimony from Lois Keithley from Boston, America, identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. My name is Lois Keithley, K-E-I-T-H-L-Y, and I am the director of the Massachusetts Tobacco Cessation and Prevention Program in Boston, Massachusetts. And I thank you very much for providing this opportunity for me to testify. I have been asked by the American Heart Association to give a very brief description, summary of an initiative we had in Massachusetts that very much relates to encouraging smokers to quit smoking. We developed a cessation benefit with our Medicaid population. in 2006, in which we provided access to all FDA-approved medications, any combination, so NRT, Chantix, bupropion, and up to 16 face-to-face counseling sessions. We had very low co-pays for our Medicaid population. They were $1 to $3. And we did not require counseling for the coverage of medication. And what we found roughly 2.5 years later is that 40% of the Medicaid members used the benefit. We had a total number of people using the benefit of over 75,000. And we looked at smoking prevalence, and it decreased from 38% of the Medicaid population before the benefit was instituted to 28% of the population after it was instituted, which is a substantial decrease in such a short period of time. We then looked at claims data from those smokers who utilized the benefit and found a 46% decrease in the probability of hospitalization for heart attack and a 49% decrease in the probability of hospitalization for acute coronary heart disease. And being good statisticians, we control for a variety of demographic factors, prior health risks, state influenza rates, so those benefits were obtained in 12 to 18 months after the smoker utilized the benefit. We then worked with George Washington University, who released a study, I think it was just last month, looking at an ROI, a return on investment. And they looked in a national data set and applied the findings that we found with our smokers from Medicaid who used the benefit. And they estimated that for every dollar that was spent on this mass health benefit, there was a savings of $3.12 in terms of decreased cardiac cost for decreased cardiac hospitalizations. So there was a net health care cost savings of $2.12. And again, those cost savings accrued within 12 to 18 months of using the benefit. So we feel that this study provides strong evidence for the fact that encouraging smokers to quit smoking can, in fact, offset health care costs.
Thank you, Lois.
So if there's an opportunity for questions or anything, but I do thank you very much for this opportunity.
We have one question, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you forward to the committee that study so that we can have it?
Yes. I will do that.
Yeah, they'll tell you just send it to the my office, and you can get that information, and I'll distribute it to the committee. Representative Miller also has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lois, thank you so much for staying up in your office late this evening. I'm assuming it's about 7:30 where you are.
Yes, 7:30 exactly.
Well, there you go. In the one statistic that I picked up on, you indicated that at somewhere between 12 to 18 months, $2.12 of savings was appreciated. Can you give me the rest of that? Is that per person? Is that per year? Is that per month? What's the rest of that $2.12?
The $2.12 is essentially for every dollar that is spent. So there's money spent on the medications. There was some money spent on the counseling. There was some money spent on the promotion. There was some money in staff time. So we kind of added all those figures up and then looked at the costs that are associated with those acute cardiac conditions. and then looked at the costs and the savings. And so the $2.12 is not per patient. It's more for money that was for an outlay, for money that was spent.
So
does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. So I'm just going to try and summarize it by saying it was profitable.
Yes.
That's what I was after.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you. On the counseling sessions, were those attended at a local area, or did people have to go to a centralized place, and did the insurance or did the project pick up the transportation costs?
That's a very interesting question. That, I think, reflects the differences in our state. We would never consider transportation costs as a cost, but in fact it is. This study is based on people who use the benefit, and in fact we had a low rate of counseling. Maybe 1-3% of the claims were for counseling. And the way the benefit was designed was that people could bill for counseling only if it was done in a hospital or a community health setting. But those were the two venues in which the treatment could take place. So there was no reimbursement for travel.
Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Thank you again for staying up and
talking. Everything.
If I hesitate to ask a question because it's going to reveal the fact that I my mind wandered at a very crucial minute. But this program, was it a government provided program, or was it ours is looking at private insurance, and I just didn't get with clarity what the program was there, and I apologize if you could repeat that.
That's okay. I was told to keep my remarks to 3 to 5 minutes, so I was kind of rushing through.
Thank you for respecting that request.
this was with our Medicaid population, so it was strictly a government program, and in fact it was mandated by our legislature.
Thank you, Lois. And I just want to point out that I don't think anybody on this committee would argue that it's the benefit of tobacco cessation. We're more struggling with who pays and whatever. But thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure.
Okay, what I'm going to do is go ahead and close public testimony again, go back to the bill. But I do have someone has called in from California and Seattle, American Health and an insurance company. And if they will notify us that, that you have a time crunch, we'll do the same thing for you. Otherwise, we'll go back to discussion and questions related to bill. And I want to say, too, for the record, that we've been joined by Vice Chair Representative Dick and Representative Millett. So welcome. Okay, we're back to questions on the bill. Does anyone else have any questions for the sponsor or the sponsor staff?
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Representative. I'm curious, the question I asked there, of course, and it was on Medicaid population and there was no travel. I'm not sure whether if this is supposed to be across all Alaska, and we provide a benefit. Is that benefit going to include transportation to a place where the tobacco counseling sessions can be given? And if we don't have an answer to that at this point, it's a question that I do want to put up for consideration. Thanks.
Thank you. We'll be glad to clarify it.
I have a question. Are there other private insurance coverage medical insurance. We're talking medical insurance. They cover counseling and this way, substance abuse. I mean, when it's medical insurance, is this a kind of a new angle on this thing to require counseling? I mean, are there other things that Premier or Blue Cross or one of the great insurance companies are required to provide counseling for, cost for counseling?
Chair Keller, thank you for the question. I apologize. I'm not adequately prepared to answer that right now. However, I can get back to you soon. There are also people in the room from the department and Linda Hall of the Department of Insurance who may be able to answer that.
Okay. Representative Millett.
Thank you. I apologize to the committee for being late. Do you know if the state of Alaska covers tobacco cessation? Is it part of our, as public employees, do they cover our, if we want to quit smoking?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Millett. I apologize again. I would like to defer that question to the Department of Health and Social Services
when
you're able to
speak. Thank you.
Another question for you, if you would. While you're checking on my other one, this kind of goes along with it. The over-the-counter medications that are available, if there's other insurance coverage that covers over-the-counter medications, and I think Representative Seaton alluded to it, but the second part of the bill in Section 2, you know, those other requirements that where this coverage may not require pre-authorization, and I'm thinking, so that means that it's only, it implies to me that the only authorization decision of who is the person that's looking for the treatment. In other words, they go out there and they get whatever treatment they like. You know, maybe. You know, I'm just saying why. You know, and there's no doctor referral and then you mix that with over-the-counter, and it is confusing. In other words, what do I do? Do I go down and say, can I go down to the drugstore if this were to pass, buy a tobacco cessation medication, and then just directly submit the bill, you know, for the coverage? It just seems like that's out of the norm. That's what I'm trying to get at. not the norm, for sure. Sponsors, did you want to respond to that?
Sure. Well, those are good questions, and we look forward to bringing back answers for you.
Thank you. Representative
Millett. Thank you. So I also have a question about the over-the-counter medication. So my question is it a cost issue that people can't buy the over-the-counter medication? I mean, you know, we don't prescribe Sudafed because you can buy it over-the-counter. I mean, so is it a cost issue for, do you think, for this bill that you – it's just a barrier to getting people off tobacco as a cost?
Through the chair, from what we've heard, yes, Representative Millett, we've heard from several people from different parts of the state that the primary barrier to them is cost.
And can I follow up?
Follow up.
So with the tobacco award that we received a few years ago, was there any move towards offering these type of over-the-counter products as needed basis rather than mandating an insurance to pay for them? Was there any talk, or is there talk of, I think there's still some tobacco money, if I'm not mistaken, still available. Is there any talk of making those, using some of those funds and making them available to offer free to those people that it's cost prohibitive to? I mean, is there any investigation into using those funds for that?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, I would like to get back to you as quickly as I can.
Sorry,
on that. No, it is a good question, and there may also be other people in the room who can answer it for you immediately.
So, any other questions at this point? If not, what we'll do is go to public testimony. So, okay. So, public testimony is open again, and I think what we'll do is we'll start with our caller from California, if I can find the name, and because that's, I guess there's a 2 hour, right? Or an hour?
1 hour.
Okay, Jamie, are you online?
I am. Thank you very much.
Jamie Morgan, if you would, identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and give us your testimony.
Absolutely. Thank you again for allowing me to testify today. My name is Jamie Morgan, and I am with the American Heart Association, and we wholeheartedly support HB 209. Addressing the problem of smoking is a core component of the American Heart Association's mission, and we know that unrestricted access to smoking cessation treatment dramatically improves the success of cessation attempts, in some cases more than a doubling of the odds of successfully quitting. And the health benefits for those who do quit are astounding. After 1 year off cigarettes, the excess risk of coronary heart disease caused by smoking alone is reduced by half. And after 15 years, the risk is similar to that for people who've never smoked. As you probably know, smoking is the leading cause of preventable death and a major risk factor for heart disease, stroke, and cancer. And most smokers want to quit, but in order to stop this deadly habit, they need access to evidence-based cessation services. When people who smoke have unrestricted access to cessation treatment, they are more likely to successfully quit. One study shows that if regular counseling was offered to smokers, over 70,000 lives could be saved each year. We believe HB 209 will mean improved public health, cost reductions for treating chronic disease, and it will result in widespread economic gains and positive effects for business. We believe this bill will save lives and money and urge your support. Thank you so much.
Thank you for giving us your testimony. I don't see, or I see one question. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jamie, if I may call you Jamie, since you introduced yourself that way. Thank you. I know you that you're actually with the Heart Association, and you may be the wrong person to ask this question of, maybe someone else here, so I just want to leave it hanging. Any number of ailments have been described as being impacted and negatively by the use of tobacco. I read something some years ago, and I don't know that it's still the case, if anybody could answer. But isn't smoking also related to an increased incidences of miscarriages?
Actually, I believe you are correct. I'm just looking quickly if you will indulge me.
I'm also...
The benefit of cessation does minimize the low birth rate of infants and sudden infant death syndrome and other illnesses and life-threatening conditions for the mother and child.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I don't see any other questions at this time. Jamie, thank you again for your testimony. Appreciate it. Let's go to another American Cancer Society person. Pat, is it Renega? She's in Anchorage.
Yes, sir.
If you would, give us your testimony. Identify yourself for the record and who you work for.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Pat Renega. I'm a registered nurse with a background in behavioral health, and I am the lead advocacy volunteer for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I would like to urge your support of House Bill 209. Tobacco has had and continues to have devastating adverse health effects on Alaskans. In the past, the legislature has supported our comprehensive programs, and tobacco cessation coverage is one of the most cost-effective health insurance benefits that is available. It is hard to quit. It is possible with programs that are evidence-based. Thank you for your support of tobacco control efforts in our state.
Thank you, Pat. How many times, typically, do you know, maybe not the one to answer, but how many times does the statistics say you have to try to quit before you could quit? I mean, this bill says it covers, what is it, a couple times a year, is it? And
yes, sir. I'm sorry, I got an echo. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Typically, smokers attempt up to 10 times before they are successful, but each attempt helps to become successful for the next time. And currently, there are 71% of the Alaskan adult smokers who want to quit.
Thank you for that good information. Thank you for your testimony. I don't see any questions, so we'll press on here. We also have, just so you all know, we have Allison from the Department of Public Health online to answer questions, and we have the chief medical officer in the room from Public Health. So if you have any questions you'd like to direct at them, they're just standing by in case we have questions. But we want to go at this time to Sheila Talbin from Seattle, right?
Hello, thank you.
Sheila, if you would, just identify yourself for the record and tell us who you represent and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sheila Tolman with Clamera Blue Cross, and I'm here today to speak in opposition to House Bill 2009 in its present form. We have submitted a letter to the committee members outlining our concerns and some suggested amendments to this bill for your consideration. Clamera currently provides comprehensive coverage to our members, including innovative programs focused on wellness and prevention, and we have a long history of supporting smoking cessation programs. Currently, the majority of our plans currently cover tobacco cessation counseling and treatment programs to help our members achieve their smoking cessation goals. If the plan covers prescription benefits, certain prescription drugs are also covered without any cost sharing. Some of our plans also cover over-the-counter medications, but this can be considered a custom benefit, and so groups may have the option of doing that. Per the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, also known as the Federal Health Care Reform Law, non-grandfathered health plans, which include insured and self-insured plans, must cover preventive services without any cost sharing for the member. So tobacco cessation counseling and interventions are included in this preventive health benefit. So the majority of plans should already be providing these benefits. One of the concerns that we have with House Bill 2009 includes a provision that removes critical cost control tools for health insurers. Insurers today utilize appropriate medical management tools such as prior authorization to control costs and ensure members receive appropriate care. Further to this effect, HHS regulations that are related to the preventive care services under the Health Care Reform Law specifically states that nothing prohibits insurers from implementing reasonable medical management techniques. So our concern is that the language in this bill goes against this approach. Thank you, Chair Keller and members of the committee. I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you might have. And I guess with respect to the amendment that was mentioned earlier, you know, that's something we'd be willing to take a look at and consider kind of a mandated offering type of approach. But we do have concerns with the sections that remove some of the critical tools that insurers can use today. Thank you.
Representative Miller has a question for you, but before he gets started, our system, which is flawless, evidently failed. We do not have your letter, and I would appreciate it if you would maybe fax it to my office, and we will distribute it to the committee. Representative Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as a point of fact, I did receive that letter. So I sort of had a question prior to even getting here. Sheila, thank you very much for being with us this evening. I'm not much of an expert on insurance, and there were two phrases that you just used that I also noted in the letter that I would like you to discuss just a little bit, because I just need the education. When you indicate that there is no cost sharing, I need a little further definition of that, and you also mentioned cost control methods or measures or so forth. Could you just tell me a little bit more about those?
Sure. Through the chair, cost sharing refers to any member's out-of-pocket costs. So this would include co-payments or co-insurance. So basically, when the member goes to the counseling session or to receive these prescription drugs, if they are on these non-grandfathered plans, they would be receiving that with any out-of-pocket costs.
All right, thank you.
And with respect to the cost control tools, insurers utilize various medical management techniques across a variety of services. So this can include having members go through prior authorization to make sure that the service, treatment, drug is covered. There's also tools of being able to review the frequency that members are receiving certain services and treatments, and this is all to ensure appropriate frequency utilization and that overall costs are being kind of managed from a broader perspective.
Thank you.
Representative Millett has a question for you.
Thank you. Thank you for being online. I appreciate it. My question has to do with the consistency of insurance companies. Do you cover a lot of over-the-counter prescription drugs in your plans? There's various things that are over-the-counter that you you pay for?
Through the chair, with respect to smoking cessation, I'm not exactly sure. I do know that some of our plans cover things like various gums and lozenges, if they are, you know, submitted through over-the-counter, but I do know that certain over-the-counter drugs can also be paid for if the member has a health flex account. That can certainly be used to pay for that those sorts of medications.
Okay, and then a follow-up. So, In the first part of the bill, I noticed that there's the tobacco cessation counseling and then over-the-counter medication. And one of the things I was curious about when insurance companies look at bills like this, there's no link to those two. So they could get the over-the-counter medication, and the insurance company would have to prescribe it, but there's not a link or mandatory counseling to make sure that they know how to use or getting the correct medical care to get off tobacco. Is that a problem for you?
I do know that some of our plans, I think the majority of our plans will cover cessation counseling and or treatment programs in which the member actually does get the drugs or the gums at those counseling sessions. Mm-hmm. I can't speak for other insurance plans that might have different benefit designs, but I think we have some more flexibility in allowing the member to either go to the doctor to get a prescription without doing a counseling program first.
It would seem to me, Chairman Keller, that those two would go hand in hand rather than doing one without the other. It seems to be a double attack on the problem. Sorry, commentary.
Okay. Sheila, I want to express my gratitude for your call. We every now and then come across a question related to an insurance mandate, and we often don't hear from the insurance companies. So I personally am very grateful that you called, and you can bet we're going to keep your contact information, and you may get requests for future hearings. But just say thank you especially for calling in.
Oh, you are very welcome. Thank you very much.
Okay, I believe we have exhausted the list of people that have called in, and I don't really have anybody in the room that has asked to testify. Linda Hall is here from the Division of Insurance, also here to answer questions if the committee has any, but is there anybody in the room that didn't sign up that would like to testify? And if they're online, it's probably too late because they're muted, but they will let us know real quick. Otherwise, we're going to close public testimony for now on this bill and set it aside, and we'll move on to HB 310. HB 310, I'm going to let the same scenario here. The sponsor is Representative Herron, and Liz, if you can feel free to come up now, because my guess is you're going to be needed up here, right? For questions or whatever in the presentation. And if you would tell us about the bill and press on.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've asked Liz to come forward for technical assistance on the legislation, proposed legislation, and appreciate the opportunity to hear this one as well. And look forward to hearing testimony and how may the committee, if need to amend it for successful passage. Mr. Chairman, for many years, the Alaska Immunization Program has benefited from federal grant money, using to provide vaccines to underinsured children, uninsured adults who not otherwise have access to them. But as you know, the reductions have taken sharp cuts And in FY 2013, it'll be $700,000 from the federal government, 84% loss since the those reductions began. We know the public health benefits for immunizations, and thanks to these preventive vaccines, life-threatening, life-altering diseases that were once common are now virtually unheard of. But without continued prevention, they still have a constant threat. We have health professionals here today that can elaborate on some of those dangers. Now, Mr. Chairman, of course, you're a member of the ex officio member of the Health Care Commission, and though the commission does not specifically endorse legislation, if I could read from the report, that the state encourages the state to adequately support a program that improves immunization rates in order to protect Alaskans from serious preventable diseases and their complications. And so that's an important statement from the commission. Now, of course, there is a companion bill on the other side, and Senator Geisel is working hard. It is in Senate Finance. And so I believe that if it's this legislation or the senator's legislation, I think it'll benefit all Alaskans. And I appreciate the people that have signed up to provide their testimony, and look forward to the committee's consideration. And then one little bit of housekeeping, Mr. Chairman, is Carl Rose and the Association of Alaska School Boards has asked that their statement be read into the record at the appropriate time.
Thank you, and thank you for sponsoring the bill. It's a being on the Health Commission, I'm going to comment because you mentioned that. Being on the Health Commission, I have become painfully aware of the dangers of continually expanding health care coverage. But this particular one, is probably a cost savings measure. I think I'm probably convinced. However, I appreciate you for bringing the bill forward. I did not because of my uneasiness with the situation we're facing with health care. There's a cliff ahead. But this particular one, we've been covering the cost of immunizations in the state for some time, and now the benefactor has gone away, and there's a big federal hole in the money, federal money, of $4.9 million or something that isn't there. It has to do with Senator Stevens, who was there in the past, have had the state of Alaska on a specialty list. And therefore, we were getting federal money to cover all this immunization. Now that's gone away, and we're having to step in and fill the gap. And if we don't fill the gap, the level of pain and suffering that may be out there may be far beyond the cost of the program. And the reason I'm spelling it out this way is that I want to again say that we probably will be faced with other situations like this unless we figure out how to manage our health care costs, where the federal government is no longer there in an area. We have been covering something and then press on. So that may be a convoluted way to say thank you, Representative Herron, but I do appreciate you bringing this forward. I considered making it a committee bill, and then then you stepped forward, and I appreciate that. So did you have anything, Liz, that you wanted to add to your boss's testimony?
No, thank you.
Probably a wise choice. Huh? Any questions from the committee for the sponsor or the sponsor staff? If not, we're going to go. Representative Miller?
Just a thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chairman, excuse me. Forgot where I was. Just in a very cursory look through the bill, I'm concerned with page 3. Lines 3 to 7, there are various and sundry verbs used here, I guess. There's no other way to describe it. There's the word recommended, and then there's the word approved. and they all seem to fall under the guise of what the commissioner may or may not do. And then I note that two specific vaccines or types of vaccines may not be approved. I'd sure like some discussion about that.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Representative Miller, I believe there's going to be testimony specifically on that section of the legislation, and that I believe there will be testimony, and I would support that we should not preclude the commissioner absolutely from making that determination. It should be there should be an opportunity, but the dialogue that we're going to have on this will basically get right to the point of, for example, HPV. So, and the advantages and disadvantages of having the state of Alaska have that ability to approve those vaccines as necessary.
A question that I have, if you would, and this is probably you'll defer to the Department of Public Health, and that's fine, but this will help him, the chief medical officer, think about it before he comes up to testify. But the it talks here about recommended the recommended immunization. I would presume there are different providers, pharmaceutical providers. Is this saying that the department is the one that's going to make the selection of who the provider is going to be, as opposed to the provider having input into, I want this brand, I want that brand, I just, because I don't think the bill is very specific on that. It just talks about the recommended vaccine. I'm just trying to figure out how that process, it's probably learning for me, how that process works, how it becomes a recommended vaccine.
Representative Keller, Mr. Chairman, is you raise a flag that we should fully engage in the discussion. But I, yes, sir, I would defer to my elder over here that's probably one of the smarter guys in the room. So,
okay. I have learned, Representative Herron, that I do not contradict what he says without getting my getting it figured out before it's over. And I also agree with your comment on his wisdom. Any other questions? If not, we're going to open public testimony then on HB 310, and we're going to start with Dr. George Brown. Now lives in Douglas, but used to live in the best part of Alaska.
Western Alaska?
Fairbanks. I think he means Fairbanks.
Chairman Keller and committee members, I'm going to speak for my fellow pediatricians at the McLeish Pediatrics, and then I want to share very briefly some testimony I gave on Senate Bill 144. My name is George Brown. I live at 1640 2nd Street in Douglas. This is a letter, and I have a copy of this letter, which you will all have, from the five pediatric care providers at Glacier Pediatrics here in Juneau. Dear HESS members, please support HB 310. It is critical that children and families in our great state receive and have access to vaccinations, not only to ensure the overall health of our youngest, but also to decrease the possibility of dangerous infections ravishing our state. As a state that is working on improving our vaccine rates, it can only happen if we continue to have vaccines available for all of our citizens. As pediatric health care providers, we know that if the Alaska vaccine program decreases or ends its subsidy, the people who will suffer are the working uninsured. We urge you to support House Bill 310. And that's signed Dr. Monica Gross, Dr. Amy Dressel, Dr. Kathy Steppen, Marilyn Arvald, pediatric nurse practitioner, and myself. One of the real concerns that we have about this, I mean, as healthcare providers, number one is health. And we know from a vast amount of experience that vaccines prevent death and serious illness. But we also have to be concerned about cost, and there's a huge amount of waste in the healthcare industry, and I applaud you for being concerned about that. We can't keep just wasting money the way we do, but providing vaccines not only is not wasting money, it's saving money. In the testimony I gave in the Senate, it was shown very clearly in the 90s and early in this decade that, or in the first decade of the 21st century, that for every dollar spent for the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, we saved $16. More recently, here in Juneau, several years ago, we had an outbreak of whooping cough. And I want to explain the big difference between the vaccines that prevent bacterial infections and those that prevent viral infections. Whooping cough is a bacterial infection. And the vaccines for those kinds of infections require boosters. Tetanus is another one that's commonly called lockjaw, and another one is diphtheria, which we all know about in Alaska because of the dog Baldo, etc. But in Juneau, 3 or 4 years ago, there was an outbreak of whooping cough. And had we not been providing DTaP, which is the vaccine that prevents whooping cough, and diphtheria and tetanus, it would have been far worse. But we also know we are now vaccinating older people for this, which means there will be fewer outbreaks of whooping cough in the future. At the time, the vaccine DTaP cost about approximately $2.50 or $3 per person. And I did some calculations from the cost of hospitalization at Bartlett Hospital in the recent years when this happened. And the average cost for a child that had to be admitted, and several of them did, and some had to be medevaced to an intensive care unit, particularly the small babies because they get very sick, is several thousand dollars per hospitalization. So I'm sure that vaccine prevented or reduced a lot of cost. And so I want you to know that this is very, I think the word Representative Miller you used was productive. It definitely will save a lot of money, but more importantly, it could save some major catastrophes. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
I was hoping you could just clarify. TDAP, I'm not familiar with that, and you indicate that that's for whooping cough?
T means tetanus.
Oh.
D means diphtheria.
Okay.
P means pertussis, and that's whooping cough. But the reason there's a big difference, I say DTaP and TDAP, it gets very confusing. TDAP is a vaccine that can now be given after 7 years of age, which means that adults, you can be through the lifespan, can now get a vaccine against whooping cough, which means there's going to be much less whooping cough.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to go now to Rosalind Singleton online. She's a pediatrician, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Are you there, Rosalind?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. Please go ahead with your testimony.
I am a pediatrician from Eagle River, Alaska. I work with Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And as a longtime pediatrician, I'm testifying in support of House Bill 310 to help reinstate state-provided vaccines for underinsured children and underinsured and uninsured adults. And I'm going to give just some testimony from my experience with vaccines in Alaska. Vaccines have been critical to the health of Alaskans for many years. Before vaccines for hepatitis A, Alaska had massive epidemics of infectious hepatitis A every 7 to 10 years. In one of these outbreaks, there were 4,000 Alaskans who became ill with hepatitis A. And in the last outbreak in 1992, four Alaskans, two of them teenagers, died. These epidemics required a monumental public health response costing hundreds of thousands of dollars. In 1995, an effective hepatitis A vaccine was licensed and routinely recommended and funded for children. Hepatitis A infections have precipitously decreased in the state. We now have one of the lowest rates among all the states in the United States. And that's been a huge benefit, both from saving huge amounts of public health dollars and also the cost of illness and death. In the 1960s, over 5% of infants in Southwest Alaska who were 1 to 11 months of age died in the first year of life. Half of these deaths were secondary to measles and pertussis. That wasn't that long ago. The infant death rate fell tenfold between the 60s and the 80s. And much of that was because of effective vaccines. Since 1997, Alaska has been free of measles outbreaks, thanks to measles vaccination and routine requirements in schools. And in the past few years, hundreds of outbreaks have occurred in the U.S., and we have been spared. But any decrease in our measles coverage could result in outbreaks. As you're well aware, because of these staged federal funding decreases, in 2011, the state stopped providing any adult vaccine. In 2012, the state is no longer providing childhood vaccines to children who do not who are not eligible for federally funded vaccines. This bill helps to reinstate some of this these vaccines until a longer term solution can occur. So what will happen if this bill doesn't pass? If this bill doesn't pass, then next year the state will only provide vaccines to children who are eligible for federally funded vaccines. Unfortunately, when faced with fronting the cost of expensive vaccines, many small medical practices will stop providing vaccines. And when faced with the high cost of vaccines, many parents are right now deferring vaccines until they're absolutely necessary for school. This decrease in access will result in a decrease in our delicate balance of immunization coverage and can lead to an increased risk of outbreaks from these diseases that I've just recited and others. And it will also leave our state without an adequate vaccine supply to respond to outbreaks. So we'll be more at risk for outbreaks, and we will be less able to respond to outbreaks. That's the end of my testimony, but I want to also answer the question about HPV and meningococcal vaccine and why those are not included in the bill. The whole reason why those vaccines are not included is cost. HPV vaccine and meningococcal vaccines are important vaccines, but they're costly, newer vaccines. And in order to get a bill that is going to be tenable for passage, those two vaccines were left out, and the chief medical officer can add more detail about that. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Singleton. I just want to point out to the committee that the fiscal note has an extensive write-up. It's a full page, and you may want to look at that before we come back to the bill anyway, and it confirms, it talks about the cost-benefit ratio a bit there, and it may generate another question you may have. Thank you, Dr. Singleton. I do see a question. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not a question, just a comment. Appreciate the testimony by Dr. Roz. is she's not a constituent, but for the YK Delta, the Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation, and the region in whole, she's a superstar.
Representative Dick also has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Singleton, just a statement to comment. One statement, when my wife was 2 years old, she lost her mom to measles, so our family would have been vastly different if this had existed back then. But I wonder, were you referring to hepatitis A? Do we have any knowledge whether that existed pre-contact or early contact? Was that always here?
It probably was. We only started testing for hepatitis A several years ago. So, and many, you know, people have had hepatitis and yellow jaundice for many years. It's very interesting that you bring that up, because one of the other incredibly huge success stories in Alaska is regarding hepatitis B, which is another form of hepatitis. In the 60s and 70s and early 80s, Alaska, especially in southwest Alaska, had the highest rate of chronic hepatitis B. And we had teenagers dying of liver cancer related to hepatitis B. In the 1980s, Alaska started vaccinating for hepatitis B. And now we have good coverage rates, and Alaska Native people as a whole have the lowest rate of hepatitis B of any racial or ethnic group in the U.S. That's a huge success story. So I can't answer the question about whether hepatitis A and B were individually here for how long, because testing for those vaccines, for those diseases, was only available in the last 30 years or so.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again. Just so we know the sequence here, I'm going to take one more testimony here from Randy Sweet, United Way, who's online. And then we have Dr. Hurlburt here. And before I call him up, I'll be reading in the testimony from Carl Rose. I don't see anybody else online. If there's anybody out there that wants to testify, now's the time to let us know. And I don't have anybody else in the room signed up to testify.
Mr. Chairman, does anyone have a spare copy of the fiscal note? I don't seem to have one.
I sent her spare.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
you.
Great. So at this time, online, Randy, are you there? If you would state your name, and we'll proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Randy Sweet with United Way of Anchorage. United Way of Anchorage supports HB 310 and the stopgap funding for the Alaska Immunization Program through 2015, and a thorough framing and analysis to develop a long-term funding resolution so that vulnerable children and adults are able to receive needed vaccines. United Way of Anchorage is working with our partners so Anchorage residents have access to quality health care and practice healthy behaviors. Access to vaccines is critical to individual health and wellness and to public health. By providing access to vaccines, children are able to stay healthy, start and stay in school. Adults are able to stay on the job because their children are healthy and they are healthy. From an economic development standpoint, a healthy Alaska is attractive to companies locating their businesses here and remaining here. Lastly, our Constitution states that the legislature shall provide for the promotion and protection of public health. By providing this temporary solution, the legislature is able to promote prevention of illness and protect the public health of Alaskans from unnecessary exposure to and spreading of disease and associated illness or death. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your testimony. There's one more called in, Murray Sullivan, Alaska Primary Care, I believe. Or Murray, is it? Are you there?
Mary.
I got
it's Mary. I think they just wrote my name down wrong.
Okay, great. If you would, go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent and give us your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Keller. For the record, my name is Mary Sullivan, and I'm with the Alaska Primary Care Association. I am calling in to testify in support of this piece of legislation And, you know, we represent all of the community health centers. That there's about 143 of those around the state. And they're mostly small clinics, like the clinics described by Dr. Rod Singleton, who would be severely impacted by the fact that the funding is going away for these important serums for the immunization. In fact, we've gotten some testimony already, and the cuts aren't finished yet, and already we're getting some reports from some of our clinics that, for example, in Talkeetna, they are expecting to be zero compliant this year with their two-year-old immunizations rates, and that they've been trying to keep up with it and been trying to purchase everything they can. They've already overspent their budget for immunizations this fiscal year, and still expect to be zero compliant. And part of that is the issue of parents not wanting to immunize their children, but most of it is the fact that they can't keep up with the cost of immunizations. There's so many more immunizations required now than there were in the past. And so that's just one example. Many of the smaller clinics are already struggling. And if the funding was to go down, and it's planned, I mean, we know it's going down, if the funding stopgap that's included within this piece of legislation isn't passed, then we can expect that more and more clinics will be zero compliant, which obviously increases our risk for public health, serious public health issues such as the outbreaks of diseases like measles, mumps, rubella, pertussis, and the other serums that are listed in that piece of legislation. As to the meningitis or meningococcal and HPV issue, we did talk about that with some of our providers, and they were not concerned with the language that's in the bill currently. They're more concerned that this pass. This is set to sunset in 2015, and if we can come up with a more sustainable plan between now and then, which I know is already being worked on by Senator Geisel and others, with Premiera and other people looking at lots of different models, you know, if we come up with some better funding streams or more funding streams, then, you know, the possibility to include more of the expensive serums like the HPV and the meningococcal serums could be included later. So we're not real concerned that they're not included currently in this piece of legislation. We are, however, very concerned that the other serums that are listed and then the ones that would be approved by the commissioner do get some funding. And the other point I'll make about that, too, is we heard from a couple providers that if they were able to get increased funding for some of these other vaccines, there might be money in their immunizations budget to purchase some of those more expensive serums. So just because they're not covered in this piece of legislation doesn't mean that they won't continue to be provided at clinics that can afford to do that. But the clinics will absolutely not be able to afford them if there isn't something that's done now to provide funding for the others. So that covers my testimony, and I'll take any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Mary. We're used to seeing your smiling face here, so when I got your name with one letter off, I missed it completely. But thank you for your very valuable testimony. We have one question, I guess, here. I'm sorry, Representative Millett.
Thanks. Maybe you can answer this question. So when it comes to adult vaccinations, is shingles one of the recognized recommendations for adults?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, as I understand it, shingles is a vaccine that is recommended for older adults. I believe it's covered by Medicare. I would defer to Dr. Hurlburt and others who have more knowledge about that, and I can also follow up with some of our providers and find out from them their thoughts on it. But that's all the information I have right now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. I'm going to read in testimony from the Carl Rose from the Alaska Association of School Boards. AASB supports HB 310, SB 144. AASB believes that the health, welfare, safety, and education of Alaska's children and youth are in our highest priority. As such, AASB supports the establishment of a child and Adult Immunization Program in the Department of Health and Social Services. Thank you for reading my statement of support to the committee. Carl Rose, ASB Executive Director. So we'll give that to the recorder. We have Dr. Hurlburt to testify, but I just want him to have the option of being the wrap-up. So is there anybody else in the room that wants to testify on HB 310? And I have no more notifications online. Again, my intent is to not take action on the bill. We're going to set it aside. We'll leave public testimony open. And I'll be working with the sponsor as far as what he wants to do, whether he wants to move the bill into finance or go with the Senate version or just what. We'll work that out. But we want have questions we'll want to answer. And like the one I brought up on how the process of the recommendation and who the pharmaceutical supplier is. So seeing no other testimony, Dr. Hurlburt, if you'd come forward and give us your testimony. Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ward Hurlburt. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health and Chief Medical Officer of the Department of Health and Social Services. And here in the room also is Jill Lewis, and if there are questions on the fiscal note, she may have something to help there. Mr. Chair, what time are you planning to adjourn
the session? You have 35 minutes if you want it. You can have it. Whenever, if you get done early, we'll check out. But 35 minutes before we plan to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't sure if it was 4:30 here.
Oh, okay.
I very much appreciate the testimony that Dr. Singleton and Dr. Brown have given. Those folks have spent their lives dedicated to kids in Alaska. They've both taught me a lot over the years. Dr. Singleton mentioned hepatitis B. Another name is Dr. Brian McMahon, who started in Bethel and became interested in hepatitis B, which was giving us a huge number of liver cancer cases. At the time, it was the most common cause of liver cancer worldwide. Now an uncommon cancer. Dedicated his life to that, a physician who is now respected and recognized worldwide related to the hepatitis infections and liver cancers. I've commented on him that he probably contributed as much to mankind as anybody that I've known in my life. This is a part of our heritage here in Alaska. Some of the things that we can just be terribly proud of in our small population state, but where we've helped Alaskans and helped people around the world. Dr. Singleton mentioned the 2.5% deaths due to measles and pertussis in southwestern Alaska. I started in 1961 in Kanakanak, and it was somewhat worse over in Bethel in the YK Delta area. But that was my work as a general practitioner, seeing little infants come in with measles, measles encephalitis, measles pneumonia, and dying of that. That translates to a death rate of 25 deaths of infants per 1,000 live births. Today, from all causes, prematurity, congenital malformations, everything else, infants die at a rate of just a little under 7. So it was 3.5 times what the death rate is from all causes now, today. And we're still not satisfied. It still needs to come down. And George and others commit their lives to doing that. The immunizations are interesting. Now, there have been some statistics mentioned overall. CDC generally says that a dollar spent on immunization for kids saves a little over $8. In direct health care costs, a little over $16. For immunizations overall in sickness, illness, time off work, and so on. But there is a difference between vaccines. Some of them are more cost-effective than others. Some cost more than others do. But a vaccine, and vaccines generally are not 100% effective. Vaccines are very good today, but if you know if you get a flu vaccine, if you go to the Safeway here in town and get your flu shot, it's going to reduce your chances of getting flu. And hopefully everybody in this room has done that, and if you haven't, it's not too late. But it doesn't guarantee you 100%. But the other thing that vaccines do, they not only protect the recipient of the vaccines, but they provide what we call herd immunity. And if you have a high enough level of immunization in a community, and it's generally thought to be around 80%, we'd like to shoot for 90%, but around 80%, that's enough so that the whole population is protected. So this is something that where you're immunized, you not only protect yourself, but you protect your family, you protect your neighbors. And there will be some people who, for one reason or another, do not receive vaccines. But having adequate levels does provide the herd immunity there. There were some questions. I think Representative Miller had a question about recommendations. There is the American Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP. And also the American Academy of Pediatrics that do make recommendations. They meet regularly. Those recommendations change as new vaccines come along or newer formulations, and they do change, but that's what the country generally looks to. In addition, in Alaska, we have certain vaccines that we mandate for school entry, and most states do that, so that you have to have those. That list is somewhat smaller than the recommended vaccines, and that has to do with cost effectiveness, with overall cost, and sometimes timing on that. But there are two factors here. In looking at the vaccines and in trying to be sensitive to the realities that we all live with, that there are not unlimited amounts of money. We just don't have a printing press, and there are benefits and there are costs. One of the ways that you look at various kinds of therapeutic interventions or preventive interventions is in terms of what's called a QALY, a quality adjusted life year. And I don't know if you have any of the material looking at that, but that's something that's commonly done. It involves statisticians, it involves clinical people, and so for a dollar spent for the vaccines, what do you save, and what's the value of that? And then it becomes a philosophical or an ethical issue. How much is a year worth? And nobody has the answer. That's a Solomon-type question. But what we did in looking at the vaccines, and these vaccines will be for the 25% of the kids in the state who are underinsured. About half the kids in our state still receive vaccine paid for by the federal government under the Vaccines for Children program. Alaska Native kids receive that. All the Medicaid-enrolled kids receive that. And that's about half of the state. About a quarter of the kids in the state have good health insurance, like Premera that was on here, and that pays for the vaccine. They will be a part of the overall solution, but that leaves about a quarter of our kids that are not covered. And so that's what this request is pointed toward, that group. It's important to immunize them because they are Alaska kids, and we want to protect them from the kinds of things I saw as a young doc out in Kanakanak. But we also want to protect everybody else by having them immunized. So this money goes to pay for that group of individuals. Then looking at the list of recommended vaccines by the American College of Committee on Immunization Practices or the American Academy of Pediatrics, looking at what we require for school admission, we looked at that list in terms of what is the value for dollar spent. Basically drew a line so that if the savings per quality adjusted life year was $25,000 or less, that's basically putting a value on a life of $25,000 a year in kind of a cold, hard statistical way, but we need to look at things that way. Those vaccines were covered. Those that had a benefit of a cost of more than $50,000, and that went up to like $250,000 per quality adjusted life year, those were the ones that were not picked. So the answer is why was Menactra, why was HPV, why was rotavirus excluded from that list? It is a pure cost issue. For adults, it included the flu vaccine and the pneumococcal vaccine. The flu is most deadly at the extremes of age, in the very young and the very old. For the middle age, it's not that deadly, and actually the cost is probably fairly high in terms of a quality-adjusted life year. But because of the herd immunity, if you are immune against the influenza, you're going to protect the little infant that's your child or your grandchild or your neighbor's child, and you're going to protect your mother or your father or the seniors that you have. And it's a pretty cheap vaccine to buy compared with many others. It did not include the shingles vaccine, and if any of you have had shingles, you know you would love to have the vaccine. It's about 50% effective, but well worth it if it prevents it. If we were able to manage things and have enough money, and I think the intent, I haven't had the chance to talk with Representative Herron, but I'm talking with Senator Geisel. I know her intent was to leave flexibility with the department there. And my own intuition would be probably we would extend to rotavirus and shingles if we had sufficient money to do that. But with that kind of flexibility there, let me stop at that and open for questions that you have. But I'm grateful that you're considering this.
Representative Herron. Thank you, Doctor, for your testimony. The only reason I brought up HPV and meningococcal is that there has been correspondence to my office is that that there not be language that says may not approve, but that the legislation provides. Probably puts up some high fences or corrals around those that we don't need to come. I mean, that the commissioner does have that flexibility. And that's the only reason I brought it up. But I think you've have explained it. At least I think I understand that that you feel comfortable in putting those corrals around those particular high-priced vaccines so that we can protect more people with the other vaccines.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Herron, I believe that's a responsible, prudent decision. In talking with our epidemiology people, Dr. Singleton and I have had conversations about it. I think the sense that I get is that others feel that's a prudent, sensible decision. It does not mean it's not desirable to do some of those other things, but in a real world where resources are limited, it's better to do what you can do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Doctor. It's always a pleasure to have you in front of us. One thing that I did want to ask is that you referenced a committee, and I assume they are a national organization. Are there any diseases, or I should say more specifically, more vaccinations that might be more specific just to Alaska? Do we have some occurrence that maybe is not a problem in Florida, let us say, but it's endemic here, that should be or will be on the recommendation list from the commissioner?
Through the chair, Representative Miller, basically our diseases are what are seen elsewhere. There are differences. The story that Dr. Singleton told with hepatitis A, where the vaccine is relatively recent. It used to be if you went overseas in a hepatitis A area, you'd get some hyperimmune gamma globulin, which would last about 6 weeks, and then you'd have to have another shot. That was an antibody from people that's pooled from people who had the disease and gave you some protection. Now there's a specific vaccine for it. And we went in Representative Herron's area, which is it is one of the dramatic success stories in the annals of public health history, where we had one of the highest incidences of hepatitis A of anywhere in the world to now one of the lowest through the use of that. So that was something that was here. Hepatitis B that I mentioned also was. There are not the specific communicable diseases that are vaccine preventable that are different here. There are outbreaks from time to time. California a couple of years ago had a severe outbreak of pertussis because of low levels of immunization. And they had over 2,000 kids get whooping cough, get pertussis. They had 10 infants die. Two of them had had one of their shots, not the complete series. The other eight had had no shots at all, starting in the Schwarzenegger administration and continuing in the Brown administration. They had a big push last year. They didn't have any cases, but a lot of people, a lot of cost, and a big push to do it. No, I'm not aware of anything specifically that would be different than what we see elsewhere in the country.
Okay. And one second question. And I think this is more to the sponsor of the bill. I do note in the fiscal note that we have specifically named rotavirus, that this fiscal note does not include rotavirus along with HPV and meningococcal vaccines, and I just wondered why that doesn't appear in the bill.
I don't know the answer.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you have a comment on that?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Rowland, I may be able to shed some light on that.
Yeah, go ahead.
In working through, we knew that there wouldn't be unlimited dollars just in providing advice and providing information. And in looking at the cost-benefit ratios, I think it was an evolving process to know where the line would be. It turned out it was a fairly reasonable line if you went 25,000 and below and 50,000 and above. There were not gray areas in there. One of the things that's used in the medical literature is to say that $50,000 is a break point that you look at. That's a God-type decision, but it's some people postulate that. So rotavirus did come in well above the $50,000 there. Maybe in thinking back to your last question, if I personally had to pick one of those, rotavirus might be a little more of a common problem. It's the diarrhea that you see in infants and young kids. It's why I would say if we had some more money, that's where I would probably go first with the kids. But it's also a national issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Millett.
Thanks. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it. So on the rotavirus and the shingles, you said the shingles vaccine has a 50% success rate for people who receive it. What's the rotavirus? Is it 100% or is it pretty high? It's pretty high up there, isn't it, for success when you're immunized from it?
Through the chair, Representative Miller, I don't have the answer to that. It's possible Dr. Brown might hear. But I can certainly get it for you, but I don't know the success.
And then just to follow up, if we did cover rotavirus and shingles, how much bigger would the fiscal note have been? I guess that's my question. I know we have to draw the line somewhere, and I know the conversation probably went, but I would just like to know those incremental increases that if we did decide to include shingles and rotavirus. I mean, rotavirus is, I mean, I don't know if any of you have ever seen anybody with rotavirus. It's devastating.
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Millett, we, in taking the 25% of the kids that are uninsured, and then what I didn't mention before, we also apply an 80% factor to that. We're not trying to overstate the needs there. So if you take that 25%, and use the 80% immunization rate, the rotavirus for 2013 prices for the vaccine would be $409,000.
Okay.
And the zoster or the shingles vaccine, and this is harder to do. It's not been widely accepted around the country. The numbers I see are like 12-14%, and we're probably a little lower in this state. What we did, that used to be recommended just for 60 and over. Now it's recommended 50 and over. And we took that population of the 50 to 75, just to get a number, and said if we're about 10% now, and our numbers are not as good on that, but if we took that and could get 4% more, then that would cost, it's a fairly pricey vaccine, that would cost $980,000 a year to increase the rate of shingles coverage there.
And I get one follow-up question. What is the prevalence of shingles in Alaska? Is it a higher rate than other states, or are we on the norm?
I'm pretty confident it's the norm.
Okay.
I'm not aware of anything, both from my days of clinical practice here over a long time and now in public health, I'm not aware of anything out of the norm on that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
As legislators, Dr. Hurlburt, we get in the habit and, you know, following the money, you know, trying to figure these things out, and it's a worthwhile thing to do. And I was, you said that this bill covers 25% of our kids, and you said half were covered. You said 75% were covered, 25% by private coverage, and the 50% covered by Denali Kid Care. What else?
The federal government through the Vaccines for Children program, and those eligible for that are those on Medicaid and all Alaska Native kids. Our immunization rates in our Alaska Native kids are admirable.
Right.
The rest of the state, you kind of have to hold your nose a little bit. We've come up. We were number 49 among the states for two-year-olds. We're up to 42, so we're improving, but it's still a source of some shame.
Okay, that helps. Thanks. The other question I had is help me a little bit on the providers. I mean, how many providers do we have for some of these immunization shots and treatments? I mean, is there a lot of providers? Are there, that a limited supply or what?
If I could be maybe just a little bit expansive, one of the things I didn't mention and one of the reasons for in Representative Herron's bill and Senator Giesel's bill on the other side having a 2015 sunset is to give us time to work it out. If we could procure the vaccine, if the state could procure the vaccine for all providers, number one, we could get it significantly cheaper than the private physician can ordering it from their commercial sources. But probably even more important than that, they just have to maintain one stock. If the Dr. Brown in his private practice has to procure privately for his privately insured patients, he has to have a separate refrigerator for them, another one for the Medicaid kids that he sees, and maintain two sets of supply. A lot of providers will say a pox on that. It's just too much of a hassle. If I have to do that, I'm not going to give it. So who do we have that would give it? Pediatricians, as we've heard today, are very committed to that. And would do that. So all pediatricians would, family medicine physicians who take care of kids do, nurse practitioners would. The 330 clinic, the federally qualified health clinics, can provide vaccines using federal money for uninsured kids. And others who can give the vaccine are public health nurses. So we have been able to get the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, which is a federally qualified health center, to deputize all of our public health nursing clinics as kind of like alternate federally qualified health centers, which makes them eligible for federal funding for the vaccine for uninsured kids. And that's part of what makes our 50%. We're trying to be innovative. But one of the things that I think we have to work out is some way to be able to procure vaccine from one source to make it reasonable for physicians and the private practices to want to do it, because they do want to. They want to do the right thing. They know it's important. But if it becomes too much of a hassle, they're very busy, and some will say, I can't deal with this. They can go down to the public health nurse or somewhere else.
Okay. That helps me understand. I appreciate it. How about if we have, if we do centralize and you know, as far as the supply, is there any danger as far as side effects? And because you hear horrible things out there, and that there's a lot of fear with some parents, that have chosen not to immunize. And I was wondering, HPV, for example, I think there's some stories out there, horror stories, but my real question is, if we centralize, how do we protect ourselves from digging a hole there for ourselves.
Mr. Chair, the central procurement is through CDC. It's from the manufacturers. Usually there are not a large number of manufacturers. There may be one or two. For instance, HPV, there are two manufacturers. There are a little different vaccines that are available there. So they're limited number. They come from the same manufacturer that the private practice physician would get it. And actually having the Division of Public Health do it when you're doing it all the time, you can maintain what's called the cold chain. You can keep make sure that the vaccines are handled the way it should. Now, there's what's known as parental hesitancy, and that's where parents are reluctant to have their kids immunized. There are a lot of shots. If your two-year-old's going to have 15 shots now, and it didn't used to be that way. It's very costly. It's about $1,800 worth of vaccine now for a 15-year-old. So partly for that and partly for other reasons, there's the hesitancy. We have the highest percent of parental hesitancy of any state in the country, 9%. That means education is needed there. There is information out there, for example, related to the MMR, measles, mumps, rubella, German measles vaccine there. There was a well-respected British medical scientist researcher who published an article that purported to show that the MMR vaccine led to autism. And this was widely believed. It's still widely believed. Just within the last year or so, other articles were published in the British medical literature that this was not a misinterpretation of the data. This was deliberate falsification of the data for somebody who had a bias and believed it so firmly that he, I'm sure, felt he was doing the right thing, but misleading the world. And millions of people have believed this. That individual has lost his license as a physician in England now. But there are those biases out there. And so I think it takes education, individual education between the provider and the parents or the patients, some public education kinds of things. There is a recommended schedule. Most of our public health nurses will work with parents if they say, I can't have you give little Johnny another shot now. And they say, okay, it's time, but come back 2 weeks from now or a month from now. And try to work with parents to get the shots in them. But from obviously I have a bias, but I believe by and large the reluctance on the part of parents is because they don't understand the value of the vaccines. They don't recognize what could happen that I've seen happen in my lifetime.
Thank you. I'm old enough to have some very vivid memories also, so I understand. I do have in my district, or in my area anyway, there's one community and there's a community health center, and they reported to me that they have never had a child come in that was up to date on their immunization. I thought that was a pretty scary statement, you know, 100% behind, so anyway. Seeing no other questions, I really thank you. You have helped me understand, and if you want the last word, go ahead. Otherwise, just thanks.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, thank you.